This episode of Stage 9 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
Hey, we're back together again, reunited for the first time in years. Or, you know, a couple.
It feels like years, Mike.
Yeah.
It truly feels like years. Reunited, and it feels so good.
Yeah, well, we did get to talk over on thenerdparty.com about some Star Wars stuff and George Lucas and whatnot over there on The Great Shot Kid.
That's true.
But first time back together again on Trek.fm in a while. So, yes.
You're still stuck with me, everybody. Ha, 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 ha. I'm back.
Well, you were here last week. I was gone, but you were
that's right.
with Char, so that was cool.
And it was great to have Char. Thanks again to Char for guesting. We appreciate it.
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, you guys talked about one of the writers on Discovery, Kirsten Beyer, and a book that she wrote. And this week we're going to talk about a couple more writers on Discovery and a couple more, well, prose pieces that they wrote.
Yes.
We're going to talk about Bo-Yan Kim and Erica Lapolt and their contributions to a new anthology book called Empower, Mind Over Matter. But before we get into that, there's a couple things that happened in the world of Discovery this past week.
Yes, you may have noticed that there were not many. A couple of news tidbits here and there.
A couple
of
things here and there, yeah. Mm-hmm. The news was flying fastly and furiously.
Yeah, it was
crazy. It's, you know, blues riffing B, you know?
Yeah, hey man.
Watching everyone for the changes and trying to keep up and, yeah.
The greatest thing is we went so long without, you know, they were parsing things out so teeny bit at a time. And then just to get that deluge was, it just felt good. It felt good to be having things to talk about.
But it was also really hard to keep up because there were so many different things and people and press lines and stuff just like randomly dropping like major bombs about their characters and stuff. I'm sure there's a lot more information out there than, you know, because then even like people like report on like the press conference and stuff that they did after the whole panel thing. And it's like, okay, you guys are reporting on what you think is important. I'm guessing that you're missing some stuff. So where is this press conference? And I found it on YouTube and all that stuff. You know, it's the information's out there. Like even now, this whole week, like I guess as a way, they're saying it basically as a way to promote the Vegas convention, CBS is releasing or on StarTrek.com like a story a day where they interview, or I guess this happened at San Diego, they interviewed someone associated with the making of the show, and they're doing like sort of like profile things. So Monday was Sinequa Martin Green, Tuesday Doug Jones, and they're going to continue that through the whole week. So lots of stuff coming out still.
Yeah. It's great.
And they released a trailer.
And oh, did they?
Yeah.
Not many people talking about that.
No, I know.
You know, sort of. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Bad attempt at humor. Wow. Look. Let's just go on record. Your reaction to the trailer was.
This was the thing that I took away from it more than anything else, which is weird because, you know, I mean, obviously, I know how these things work, right? Because I watch movies.
Sure.
But, you know, it's like we've spent so much time talking about, you know, the people involved in following the process from, you know, the initial conception all the way up through now. And obviously you see behind the scenes photos and stuff like that. You see all these people who are working on it. And I think at some point, in a sense, it all becomes so familiar that it seems much smaller than it actually is.
Interesting. You know?
Like, okay. You see, for example, writers on Twitter talking about getting coffee with each other and all this other stuff, or just the fact that, you know, I mean, whatever, you see pictures of offices and people sitting behind desks and, you know, Twitter accounts run by, you know, writers' dogs and, you know, plastic gorns running around all over the place. And it's just like, oh, yeah, you know, it's a bunch of nerds who are getting together to make some Star Trek or whatever. And then, you know, they drop the trailer and I'm like, wow, this is like really big. Like, this is like they put some money in this and they've got like some like really like, you know, good effects. They did some good effects on those computers there that, you know,
those computers can work wonders nowadays, Mike. And they really can.
And like, I don't know why that's surprising to me, because obviously, I mean, there's like a veil of secrecy over everything. And, you know, it's not like, maybe it's just like kind of like out of sight, out of mind, where it's like, oh, we know that they're writing because we've seen them write. You know, we know that there are some actors who are acting in this because we've seen them, you know, drive to the set to make this thing. And we know that they've at least built half sets in some cases and stuff like that. But then, like, yeah, while they weren't talking about anything, while they have been keeping quiet about all this stuff, they haven't just been sitting around saying, like, are we going to get to making this show sometime? They've actually been, like, making it, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's been amusingly distracting.
It's,
you know,
weird.
You have to give them credit for that.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. And yeah, I mean, like Doug Jones said in that press conference, like they're finishing up shooting episode 10 now. So yeah, they're a lot further along than I think anyone thought they were, right?
Well, I mean, you know, the show's going to drop on September 24th, and obviously, I mean, they're going with the approach of having it all done by the time it starts, you know, I mean, I guess that, you know, this is why they can talk about shooting the second season, you know, as some reports have suggested, so early in the process. They don't even have to wait for the initial reaction or anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it only makes sense. It's just kind of like, duh, you know, like I don't know, I had it at like episode 5 or something like that, and trying to like track all these things, and I don't know why I would think they'd only be at that when the thing comes out.
Well,
like,
I mean, keep in mind, if they're finishing shooting, you know, maybe there's enough production lead time necessary for the effects or something.
Yeah.
Depending on the episode,
he's like, you know, they keep on getting delayed and everything, and he's like, well, it takes time to do this stuff. He's like, literally just like render time, you know,
yeah,
in order to do the effects, you know. But that was my big takeaway from it. I mean, we can get more into specifics, but that was my big takeaway from it. What about you?
My big takeaway was I will watch the hell out of this show. This is always my metric for franchise stuff, to know whether it's hit the chord that I want it to hit, which is, I look at this trailer and you could take out all of the references to Star Trek and I would still say, this looks really interesting.
Yeah.
And adding the Star Trek layer just makes it even cooler, because that means that it's something really cool that also happens to be Star Trek, which I like. And so it passes the franchise test for me. And yeah. I was really excited afterward. I was like, wow. And I have to give them credit, because there's almost that first trailer for Star Trek 09 had the, you know, the Kennedy speech overlaid them, you know, putting the plates in place for the Enterprise. And this used a remake of a song from 1971. So it's like, oh, hey, it's era appropriate for, you know, what they're going for. So,
yeah, that kind of surprised me a bit. Not that I didn't like it, because I actually like that trend, but there is a trend in trailers these days of like, let's do a like slow, somber sort of techno-y cover of a pop song from, you know, 20 or so years ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm like, fine with it, man. I like it.
You know, Ghost in the Shell comes to mind, you know, things like that. You know, it's an interesting trend, but I like it. And I was surprised to see it here, though, you know.
You know, I couldn't help but wonder when it went, because I really enjoyed it. I couldn't help but think to myself, guys, you know exactly how well it went over when they had Faith of the Heart open Enterprise. Are you sort of sticking your thumb in the eye of people here? So I doubt that they were, but I kind of hope that they were.
Things have just changed. And I would be surprised if we saw that in the actual, you know, episode.
Although, who knows, given who the choice of composer is.
This is true, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Mm-hmm. So any like specifics stand out to you about this trailer?
Just the bits that, you know, I thought that the dynamic of the trailer overall, I mean, like, I can't sit there and pick out and be like, oh, this is a standout to me, but it just the way that it played got me excited. There was so much kinetic energy about what was going on. There was this sense of urgency to everything that I saw. And honestly, seeing the Klingon speak, I was like, yeah, like that got me that honestly was probably the real tipping point for me, because the Klingons, and I've said this with the designs and everything, they are alien, they are freaky, and they are dangerous to me again. They have breathed new life into a stale foe, and I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I can see that. Although I did think it was weird because, like, I you know, was like following the panel on Twitter, and then I watched the trailer after the panel, and, you know, I had just read Gretchen Berg say, like, oh, well, one of the things which is important to us is that the Klingons speak Klingon with subtitles. And it's like, oh, that's cool. And then you see a Klingon, and he's like, hey, dudes, what's up? And I'm like, wait a minute, is that Klingon? It sounds like English. I guess my Klingon's getting a lot better than it was in the past, but...
You don't even think about it. You just translate in your head as you go.
Although it was pretty cool, because I think it was today on probably Twitter. Mary Schieffo, the security officer on the Klingon ship, Laurel or something. I don't know. She has a Klingon name. Yeah. But she's like, oh, yeah, you know, we're going to be speaking Klingon. And she held up a picture of her Klingon dictionary. And it was like the cover had broken off, and there were like all these post-it notes sticking out of it and everything. And I mean, you can tell that she's been studying that thing like crazy, you know?
If there is a fan base that is going to jump all over the pronunciations, which one do you think it is, Mike? I mean, you know, Ben Burtt can roll gibberish out for Huttese, and I'm like, sure, works for me. And then, but, you know, Klingon actually has a dictionary, so...
Oh, yes, yes. No, that's definitely true. So that's cool. That's cool for sure. Some of the stuff that kind of stood out to me with this trailer, I mean, aside from the look of it, like, there's that shot of the Europa. I mean, RIP Europa, I guess. But,
yeah,
like, as that's, like, breaking up, I thought that looked really cool, you know, it stuff did. Like that. I really, really did like the look of everything. But it also really does look like they're playing around a lot in terms of, like, timeline and stuff like that. Like, if you look at, like, Sonequa Martin-Green's hair, it's much different than it was, you know, in that first trailer that we saw. And I'm wondering if there's going to be, like, a time jump, you know, at some point in this thing.
Well, I almost wonder with one shot that you pointed out on Twitter.
That was Tristan who pointed that out.
Oh, it was Tristan who pointed
it out? But I noticed it, you know?
Because what I wonder is if there is going to be a thread where we're going to have sort of flashbacks to a formative event that happened.
I think that might be right, because if you think about it, like, if it would make sense for that to happen in the first episode. But then if you look at, like, people who have been hanging around the set and stuff like that on social media, it seems like those people would really have no business being in Toronto if they weren't, you know, going to be in later episodes. You know what I mean?
So, I know what you're saying.
Yeah. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see, but I think there is going to be a much more fractured storytelling going on here, which I'm cool with that, you know?
Oh, I love, I mean, I love when they do stuff like that. I mean, just look at what, I love what they've done with Better Call Saul, where you get a little taste of his eventual fate before the seasons. And it, you know, it just gives you, you know where he ends and you know Breaking Bad's in the middle and then this is before. And, you know, I like it when they mix it up.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So, okay, let's talk about a couple of the new people who we've learned about making this show. A couple of directors' names have popped up on the IMDb. Obviously, these could be incorrect, but let's just assume that they're correct because why wouldn't they be? A couple of Scotts.
Yes.
John Stewart Scott is going to be directing episode 8 of this show. And John Stewart Scott has worked with Berg and Harberts on a few occasions, having directed such stuff as Revenge and GCB. But he's also done a lot of other rather high-profile shows like The Office and American Horror Story and Chuck and Nip Tuck and Ugly Betty and Glee. So
yeah, adaptable to different genres and different looks, you know, with everything, because I don't watch American Horror Story, but it's sort of known for its darkness. And you know, Glee of course is known for its brightness, and then there's The Office, which is known for its, you know, pseudo documentary feel. Yeah. So
what I think is probably my favorite episode of GCB, episode 7, Sex is Divine. I thought that episode was very good, very funny. So that's cool. But yeah, so that's a one Scott who's working on this show. There's like two Mr. Scotts. I guess we'll consider John Stewart Scott to be prime timeline Scotty, and then TJ Scott will be the Kelvin timeline Scotty.
Does either of them one have facial hair? Because if so, then one of them could be Mirror Universe Scott. So
does Mirror? No, but we never see. Oh, I guess we do in the.
I know. No, Spock's the only one that has the goatee, but yeah. It's become an accepted, you know, thing since then. That if you see a goatee, it typically means it's the evil person.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, regardless, TJ Scott is directing episode 11 of this show, and TJ Scott has done a number of high-profile TV shows as well, including things like Longmire and Gotham and Orphan Black and The Strain and Bates Motel and 12 Monkeys and Constantine and all of this stuff, right? But to me, you got to go all the way back to the beginning of his career to find the fried gold as...
Okay.
Yeah. And that is Cleopatra 2525. Now, you haven't seen Cleopatra 2525. You hadn't even heard of it, which to me is insane. Because, okay, let me just say, I see like TJ Scott.
That's
listed,
what's insane. Not watching the show is insane. Okay.
You know, TJ Scott listed on the IMDb. I'm looking at all these credits. I'm like, Gotham, yes. Orphan Black, that's going to make a lot of people happy. Okay, yes, 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 yes. Tons and tons and tons of high profile credits. And then I see Cleopatra 2525, and I'm like, what? Yes! Oh my God! Because I watched that show back in the day. I immediately texted you, and I'm like, they've got one of the guys who directed Cleopatra 2525, and you're like, what's that?
Yes, and I'm like, that was my reaction.
What? So I sent you a link to the opening credit sequence, which is, I mean, I guess. I mean, okay, so there's, you know, a few. There's like Sopranos and Game of Thrones and the X-Files. But as far as opening credit sequences go, I would say that the opening credit sequence for Cleopatra 2525 is at the very least in like top 10 of all time, if not top 5 in television history.
You know what? I invite people to go watch the opening. It definitely makes an impression. I'll say that. I invite people to go on YouTube and look up the opening of Cleopatra 2525. Form your own opinions. Find out which, because I can tell you that I'm not putting it in the top 5. And you can decide for yourself.
Okay, just be prepared, because when you watch Cleopatra 2525 or watch that opening, you're immediately going to head on over to Amazon to purchase the complete series on DVD. I didn't have to do that because I already had a copy of it, as I showed you. I sent a picture.
That's true.
Of it.
I've seen photographic evidence. That is true.
So yeah, I'm very happy about that, because that show was amazing, you know, produced by Sam Raimi and all that stuff. So that's mm-hmm. the one thing from his filmography which really gets me psyched for this, and I love the fact that someone who used to make episodes of Cleopatra 2525 is now making Star Trek. That makes me
Everybody's got to start somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wes Craven didn't start in horror films.
So, okay, those are the two directors and that we know about. There are other directors out there, theoretically. I mean, because you look at it, I mean, T.J. Scott is directing episode 11. They've already shot 10, so there's a few. I think Frakes would probably slot in at number 9 or 10, and there's a couple of empty slots in there, so who knows? I mean, it would make sense that Olatunde Osunsamni is doing some of those things. Doug Arniakoski, as we discovered, well, 99.9% positive is directing episode 6, so that's really cool, and all that stuff. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see who else kind of like fills out that roster. But moving on to you know, something that we talked about with the trailer was the music, and that was one of two big personnel announcements which were announced at San Diego. Jeff Russo is doing the music for this show. Now, Jeff Russo is probably best known these days. I'm guessing this is why they hired him, because he's done a lot of television work on shows such as Legion and Fargo and The Night Of and like 42 other shows. But where I know him from is back in the days of Cleopatra 2525. He was a founding member of the rock group Tonic, which was another one where I'm like, because I'm like, oh my God, this guy was in Tonic? And you're like, who? And I'm like, really? I mean, I know that they're not like, you know, the Beatles or anything, but I thought that Tonic was big enough that people would know who he was.
I have a vague memory. Like, it's probably, you know, a false memory thing. Where it's like, oh, yeah, they probably had something that was big enough that I heard it at the time. I'm a few years older than you are, though.
Yeah.
So the reference shift is a little bit off for me when it comes to, you know, the rock and or roll music that you kids listen to.
No, no, I mean, I can definitely understand that. Yeah.
I still keep up with, like, you know, current music and stuff like that, but you know, stuff just misses. So you have your own tastes and everything. I want to say they were, I mean, what sort of, where did they fall into? Like what category would you drop them into?
They were in the sort of like alternative group. I mean, here, their big hit single, If You Could See, is that the name of it? I'm pretty sure If You Could See.
I have a feeling when I hear it, I'll be like, oh, that song. But I would have, you know, see, that's not entirely true. I sort of was mired a bit in the alternative, but it was the weirder end of the spectrum usually, you know, a little bit more experimental. But I also, I mean, depending on the time you're talking about, and this is now a boring conversation about my music tastes, but yeah, alternative would have been hit or miss with me, because I spent time in that section, but not a great deal of it.
So. If you could only see, sorry, that's it. No, I totally understand where you're coming from. I guess for me, like the radio station that I had on when I was in high school was Q101 here in Chicago, the alternative Q101, which, you know, I mean, and this was in pretty heavy rotation, but as far as like the spectrum of alternative, like this wasn't like Nine Inch Nails. This was more, right. I'm not going to say Blink 182, but, you know, Green Day-ish.
Okay, sure. Green Day-ish. I know where you're talking about. When were they big? Mid-90s?
Yeah, like 97, 99, that area.
Oh, I still would have been distraught about the breakup of Sammy and Van Halen. It took me many years to get over that one.
Yeah. So. I mean, if you could only see is their big one. I'm sure if you heard it, you would recognize it. But the one that I really love is You Wanted More, which is a song which came out a couple of years later, and it was in the movie American Pie. It was basically like the end credit song of American Pie.
Oh, okay, I remember that song, sure.
And they had like a video for it, which was even like on the DVD for American Pie and everything, where it takes place in like a high school, and like the lead singer is like the janitor who's like buffing the floor and stuff like that. And Jeff Russo is, I believe, the principal, and I think that's who he plays in the video. But it's I don't know, to me, like whenever I hear that song, it takes me right back to that place, because like that summer of 99, that was like the first year that I was a projectionist, and you know, we had American Pie, and it was this movie that came out like late in the summer, and it was like just sort of like out of nowhere, just blew everyone away. You know, I mean, no one thought it was going to become as huge as it was. And like we saw it first, and we, you know, since it was the end credits thing, you know, you'd hear it playing at the end of the movie, you know, as you're getting ready to thread the thing for the next show and everything like that. And then with it on the DVD and everything, which I had, it was just like that song is just like burned into my head. And every time I hear it, I just think about, you know, that summer of 99, which was an amazing summer for me. So yeah, I was really excited. It's just weird, like all of these things, like things like that, like, oh, a guy who's directing Cleopatra 2525 will one day go on to direct Star Trek, and the guy who plays guitar in Tonic will one day go on to, you know, create music for Star Trek. It's just, yeah. You know, there's no way to predict these things, and yet, you know, here they are happening, and it's kind of cool in a sense.
I think it's very cool.
The sort of random nature of it. But as far as, like, you know, the stuff that, I mean, as much as I'm sure Berg and Harbert's love You Wanted More, I'm guessing they didn't listen to that and say, oh, yeah, he's our guy, you know. I'm thinking it had more to do with, like, Fargo and, you know, The Night Of and Legion. And it's weird because even though he's done, like, 45 shows, like, I basically hadn't, like, seen any of them. But I went back and watched a couple, and a lot of his music is available on, you know, like Apple Music, which is my streaming platform of choice. And I'm guessing probably Spotify as well. So I went back and I listened to a lot of the albums. But are you familiar with any of his, you know, like television scores?
I am not. Okay. It's amazing that he has scored all of these shows that I haven't watched.
I know.
So I have to go back and rectify that.
They're like all these shows where I'm like, oh, I need to watch Fargo. That sounds so great, you know? So I watched the first episode of Fargo, and I was like, yeah, that was pretty cool. And I just watched the first episode of Legion tonight, and that was a show which I've really been wanting to see, because the way that everyone describes it and the people who kind of have been saying, like, that is good are people who I would not expect to say that about an X-Men TV show.
Right.
And the way that they talk about it is like the way people talk about like Kubrick almost, you know? And I've heard like a lot of like the people are like, this is definitely influenced by Kubrick. And I watched it and it really is that, like, it does not play like, you know, X-Men The Last Stand, for example. You know, it doesn't even play like Logan. It plays like this really abstract, fractured, like psychological study of someone who happens to be able to blow things up with their mind, you know? It's really, really good. And the photography is amazing, like the direction, the staging, and everything like that. Watching that and Fargo, which are both, you know, created by Noah Hawley, sort of like back-to-back, I'm like, wow. And this speaks to sort of like discovery, too. You know, it's like, and something that Kurtzman was saying at the press conference or whatever, he's like, there is no line between TV and film anymore. It's all the same. You know, so you got to up your game. You've got to have that high quality production value, or else people will notice and they'll reject it. And you definitely see that in these shows like Legion. I mean, it's every bit as good from a production standpoint as any of the X-Men movies, you know?
Sure.
And one of the things that really adds to that is Russo's score. It is... I mean, like, his stuff on Fargo and everything, and, like, The Night Of, like, from what I've heard, it's very stringy, kind of subdued, appropriate, but not showy or whatever. But on Legion, where it's essentially, like, reflecting the mind of someone who thinks they're crazy, but in reality is, like, basically the most powerful mutant in the world, like... It's very bizarre, and it goes. He does crazy things with the score, but it is so good. And to think that like this is just done on like a television scale.
Yeah, well, like, I'm pretty sure that watching the current season of Twin Peaks, I'll jump into Legion, and my reaction will probably be, "Yeah, this is pretty weird." It's not David Lynch weird, though.
Okay, fair enough. But there's another example of TV being like, you know, the new the new dominant form of, you know,
motion picture. Don't tell Christopher Nolan that.
What was that?
Don't tell Christopher Nolan that. He'll be very upset.
Yeah, Christopher Nolan will be very upset, but, you know, whatever. I mean, he's playing just the strengths of the format and everything, and I think that that's interesting and too, and it's all legit. And Russo's score is, for Legion, was astounding. I mean, I've just been listening to it, like, nonstop, just on my phone and stuff like that, and... It's so good. Check it out. It's so good. Is it on Spotify? It's probably on Spotify.
I haven't looked it up yet. I've been too busy re-listening to 1971 music to get in the mood for Star Trek Discovery. So I need to up my game.
The song that was used in the trailer.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, it's one of my favorite songs of all time, which is probably why.
I like it
so much. Yeah. I had the hardest time placing it because when they slowed it down and had somebody else, I was like, wow, wait, which one? I know this. And then it was actually Norm in a conversation dropped it. And I was like, yes, that's the one. So, because I haven't listened to it in a while. But
yeah, I know I've just heard that song somewhere else before recently, and I can't place it either. But
it's one of those ones that's pretty frequently used to establish time period.
Yeah,
in movies, you can almost count on here. Like if it's set in that time period, you can almost count on some character having some sort of existential moment while it's playing in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay, so we've got one more person who was announced
involved
in this show, a new cast member, the Doctor. We finally got our Doctor.
Yeah, what is a Star Trek show without a Doctor? Nothing, I tell you.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Which I've always found to be really weird because it's like, I mean, yes, I understand the need for a doctor. I'm sure they have a doctor on the ship. But it's like, do you have conversations with your doctor on an almost daily basis?
No, I do not.
And yet they seem to here on this show, right? On all of these shows.
Well, but at the same time, that does make sense because, you know, all of these ships are sort of, you know, I mean, it's naval and it's, you know, contained within the, you know, a vessel and everything. One of the most important people there is going to be the doctor who's going to be making sure that people aren't flipping out or getting sick, you know, like, if a virus gets loose inside a contained environment, like a ship, you're all kind of screwed. So you want somebody to stay ahead of that game.
No, that's true. That's true. I don't know. I have to talk. I have a friend who is in the Navy. I'm going to ask him how often he visited the doctor on his ship, but because it's weird. It's weird just the amount of interaction, you know, but it doesn't matter. And then, I mean, it's just a Star Trek thing. But anyway, yes, Dr. Hugh, not Dr. Who, but Dr. Hugh, Dr. Hugh Culber is being played by Wilson Cruz. Now, Wilson Cruz, I mean, he's, you know, been in a lot of stuff over the years, but I think, you know, the very first thing that he was in, which I think is the thing that a lot of people will remember him from, is My So-Called Life. Did you watch My So-Called Life?
On occasion, I would catch part of an episode here or there. I wasn't really... I remember how it opened and closed, and I remember Claire Danes.
Yeah.
And I remember how popular it was with a great number of people that I knew at the time, but wasn't really in my wheelhouse.
Yeah. It was one of those shows where it was so big, it seemed, and then they canceled it after 1 year, which is weird. But, you know, it was definitely...
That's sort of a Star Trek thing, so it's fitting that he's on this show.
Yeah. It's definitely gained cult status, you know, and obviously, you know, the cast like Claire Danes and Jared Leto, you know, as two of the leads in that, and who've gone on to do tons and tons and tons of stuff. But yeah, Wilson Cruz, that was his very first project, I believe. And, you know, he played Claire Danes' gay friend. And that's significant in that, and in this show, Wilson Cruz is playing Anthony Rapp's partner.
I didn't know that part. I knew that he was the doctor. I didn't know that part. I missed that one.
Yeah, yeah, because that's how they sort of like, you know, announced it. They were like, oh, you know, Anthony Rapp, you're playing the first openly gay character on Star Trek. That's pretty cool. Are you going to have a love interest? And he's like, yeah, it's Wilson Cruz, the doctor, you know.
Man, see, the thing is, though, having dated somebody at work myself, I can tell you that that's not a good plan, man.
Yeah, I know.
It'll be interesting to see how that works out. That's really not something that, I wouldn't recommend. No.
Yeah, I wonder how big Discovery is, you know?
I hope it's a very large
400?
Ship.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I actually, you know, my now wife and I worked together when we first started dating, and she basically was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm quitting and getting another job. And
yeah, I've dated people I worked with a couple of times, regretted it each time. And I've also learned, don't work with blood relatives if you can help it, because those arguments get real personal real quick when somebody messes something up at work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, the way that they talk about Discovery, they say, like, it's the best ship and everything. Although I know that, like, Enterprise is supposed to be the flagship, right? So you would think it wouldn't be bigger than Enterprise, would it? I mean, I'm thinking it can't be, right?
Why not? I honestly, I'm not steeped enough in the lore to know. My impression has always been that the Constitution class was the ship.
Right.
Like that was the big daddy.
And that's only got like 400 people on it.
Yeah. But at the same time, there's nothing to say that there wasn't a ship that was larger or comparable in size, at least. Maybe it was comparable in size, but its mission, you know, parameters were different, or its, you know, armament was different, or who knows, whatever about its profile was different. As you know, that could have a 1,000-person ship. And I know that probably that violates something about TNG, but I am the type of fan where, you know, I shrug and I'm like, okay, ship's bigger, whatever. I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say, like, I mean, that's not like a hill that I want to die on or anything like
right.
that. It's like
exactly.
The size of Discovery. I'm just curious more than anything. You know?
It's not like an adoptive sister showing up somewhere. Oh.
Yeah. I mean, as many, many people have pointed out, like, of course, I mean, I'm sure you thought of this right away, you know, Cybok, right?
Yeah, Spock didn't have a brother till 1989, and then he had a half-brother. Okay.
But like a lot of other people have said, like, he does not talk. I mean, like, if you look at Journey to Babel, right? Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, hey, that's the Vulcan ambassador, Spock, you know? And he's like, yeah, I know, I know. And it's like, well, what's the deal with you and him? And he's like, oh, he's my dad. And they're all like, what? You know, I mean, they didn't even know that, right? I mean, he's not one to, like, talk about his... He would not be dating Dr. Hugh if he were on Discovery.
I know? Think that there would be a... there's definitely a precedent. I think that people have maybe forgotten over time that Spock's relationship with his father was at one point really contentious.
Yeah.
Like it was not a healthy, happy relationship. And they healed that over a long period of time. It's completely feasible to me that somebody who is not inclined to talk about their family life, you know, oh, you had a brother? Yeah, you didn't ask if I had a brother, but yeah, okay. Yeah. You know, or you had an adoptive sister. There's no reason for me to talk about it. Like, there are people who do keep things that bottled up. They section things out. And they're like, that is not part of my life anymore. It's completely believable to me.
It's believable to me, too. I mean, when I think about, like, you know, the people who I work with, like, you know, the people who I interact with the most on a daily basis, like, I know that they have siblings. I couldn't tell you how many. I couldn't tell you their names. I couldn't tell you whether or not they live together. I couldn't tell you any of that. And these are people who I've literally worked with for like the past 5 or 6 years. You know?
Yeah.
It's just the way it works.
There are things about my life that my wife doesn't know. And not because I'm like hiding it or I'm like, you're never going to know everything about me. It just never comes up. And then every so often, and with her too, it's like, oh yeah, that happened. Wait, you never told me that. Yeah, well, it just never came up.
Yeah, yeah. So I can see that. I'm curious to know whether or not Michael Burnham exists in that capacity in the Kelvin timeline.
I do not care.
It's that's something which I just find to be interesting. And, you know, maybe she'll show up in Star Trek IV.
I doubt it too,
which is disappointing. But you know what can you do? That's pretty much it for the news in terms of the new personnel.
It's a lot of news. There's been a lot to process, like you said. Like you can't even keep up with all of it.
And you know, next week we should probably be getting some more news too with Vegas, hopefully. You know, at the very least, you know, one of the things, because they did like the comic panel before they did the disco panel. And on the comic panel, they were like, there's going to be a new Discovery comic. We really can't say anything more about it than that, but there will be more information revealed in Vegas. So I have a feeling like they had to wait until some of the stuff was said at the main panel before they could actually get into what this comic book would be about. But the comic book, you know, and I guess we kind of knew this, but, you know, Mike Johnson is writing it, but he's co-writing it with Kirsten Beyer. So that's kind of cool.
That's very cool.
And they say it's going to be rather Klingon heavy. So
yes.
So yeah.
Sign me up.
Yeah, I don't know. I get the impression that maybe it's going to be like this story told from the Klingon perspective or something like that. Total speculation on my part, but
I would love that so much.
Yeah,
I can't even put it into words how much I'd love that.
Whereas, David Mack's book, which comes out 2 days after Discovery premieres, that's going to be like a prequel book. So. That'll be exciting.
Yeah, okay. Since it's being released after Discovery comes out, it is in fact a prequel. Yes.
Yes, it is. So that's that. That's exciting news. And hopefully there'll be more exciting news in the next week or so. But let's move on to some other exciting stuff, and that is Empower, Mind Over Matter, which is a new book which was just released, which features short stories written by women who write TV shows. And a couple of the short stories in here are written by a couple people who write for Disco. The Edge of the Universe by Bo-Yan Kim and The Bus to Nowhere by Erica Lapolt. So Kim and Lapolt are a writing team. Mm-hmm. And it looks like, I guess, they wrote the Jonathan Frakes episode. So
awesome.
Episode 9 or 10, which is, yeah, it is, that is awesome. But yeah, they wrote these stories separately, which I think is interesting. You know, they're a team on TV, but then they're doing their own thing here. So that's kind of cool. And yeah, do you want to, I guess we'll just start with The Edge of the Universe, because that's the one that was in there first. You want to give sort of a description? It's weird. I don't, like, the stories are so short that in a sense I feel like any description would be like a spoiler. And I feel like talking about anything with them thematically in some ways or another is a spoiler, even if we're not talking about specifics.
You know, I don't know. I mean, Edge of the Universe, it takes place at the edge of the universe. The title tells you right there. But I think, because you noted how they, you know, oh, but they wrote these independently. I still think what's interesting is to see how they fit together. So I think it's worth talking about them as a whole, you know, if you're going to talk about, you know, themes and stuff like that, because I think that there is a tying thread, and you can see how their styles complement each other in these two stories. And you can also see their different approaches, you know, to handling certain things. But both of them have to do a lot with, you know, resolving your feelings about what made you who you are, and dealing with that and moving forward. And I don't think that spoils anything about the stories. I will say that Edge of the Universe and Bus to Nowhere were, they are very short stories, but they're pleasing. Like this is sort of like what I look for in a short story, which is, it's a little nugget. It's something to think about, and you don't, you know, you're not going to spend a great deal of time. I mean, these are very, you know, what, 15 minutes each to read them or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very quick, but I really enjoyed them. I liked them a lot.
Yeah, me too. And I definitely agree with you. I was thinking the same thing, that like thematically they are very similar. And then, I mean, having not read any other stories in the book, I, you know, started looking at the title. And I'm like, Empower, Mind Over Matter. And I'm like, was this maybe like a prompt which was given to all of the writers? Like, are all of the stories maybe about this? But these are like so similar in a lot of ways. Like even, like you said, you know, people dealing with, you know, their past and moving forward, but then even to the point of like needing to take a leap of faith, mm-hmm, in order to move on with their lives, you know, and just say like, I, you know, if I don't do anything, like I'm going to essentially die, right? You know, mm-hmm, so I need to do this, even though it's scary and it could mean total disaster, but if I don't, then, you know, then there's nothing. Then there's nothing to look forward to.
The best you can hope for is stagnation.
Right.
And you have to be willing to pick up and move on. I can say that on the strength of these two stories, which, like you, these are the only two that I've read in the book, on the strength of these two stories, I'll finish the rest of the book. And it was worth the, on Kindle, it's like $3 or something.
Yeah, like $5. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Dude, spend the money. Just go ahead and seriously, even if you just read these two stories, it's worth the money that you spent. Period.
I just spent more money on Dr. Pepper and Peppermint Patty, so you know.
There you go. Exactly.
So yeah, I but yeah, okay, specifically though, let's get into, mm-hmm, you know, the two individual things, you know,
yeah,
just kind of take a look at that.
Edge of the Universe set with Maya, who is coming there after, you know, being gone for a long time and trying to find, rediscover why she found a key in the midst of a traumatic event when she was a child.
Yeah. And what does that key lead to?
Right.
If anything. And what does that mean to her life in a sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think one of the things which I found to be really cool about this is that even though it's so short, I think that she does like a really good job of sort of like creating a believable world, a believable future world, you know, which is, I mean, it's not even on Earth, you know, it's, but there's so many sort of like touchstones to things which exist in our world, like keys and, you know, diners or whatever, you know, like things like that, that I, it's like, okay, you know, it doesn't feel like it's this super duper crazy fantasy world, but it does feel like it is in the future. And by just saying a few like tiny, tiny little things like, you know, oh, back on First Earth, or, oh, you know, that's a reference to this movie, Jurassic Park, which, you know, was made like hundreds of years ago or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. Which, you know, anytime you can sneak a Jurassic Park reference into something, I mean, hey.
Go for it. Absolutely.
So yeah, I mean, like, I thought that, that she did a really good job at that. And I also thought that it was really, and I mean, I guess the same is true for The Bus to Nowhere. Like, it felt like a television script, you know? There's like a few moments where they almost like break from like your typical narrative storytelling to like include a detail which you can tell they see in, you know, as a television writer, right? I mean, which I guess makes sense.
Right, like a script prompt.
Yeah,
The character, like, is wearing this.
Like the very last thing in The Edge of the Universe, you know, for example, you know?
Yes. Absolutely. And Bus to Nowhere is about a young woman who finds herself on a bus where there are, you know... it's fun, but you know, I almost feel like with the David Lynch reference earlier, it's like I could see this as a David Lynch thing actually, because it's
thought the same exact thing. I think maybe it's just because I've been watching a lot of Lynch lately, but yeah, no, I definitely see what you're saying.
And I think that part of the strength of these and where their experience as television writers comes in and just intrinsically lends itself is the fact that these feel like episodes in these people's lives. You get a sense that there was a before, that something came before. They give you enough detail that if this were your quote unquote first episode watching this character, you would know enough about them to go along for the ride, to say, oh yeah, okay, I'll try this out. I don't know what magic elixir that is, but I think that just the way that the descriptions were handled and the everything is established very quickly and efficiently, which I think speaks again to television, because, you know, it's all about grabbing you in that first minute of the teaser to make you want to keep watching.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, like, as far as that Lynch thing goes, I mean, there's a certain level of abstraction in, it's at the end of The Edge of the Universe too, but especially in The Bus to Nowhere, like the entire story is very, very abstract. And I don't know. There's something about it with me responding to stuff like that. Like, in the past, I've always like sort of rejected that on like a certain level. Like, I feel like, you know, stories need to have a certain blah 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 whatever. And in recent years, I think probably starting with the end of Battlestar Galactica and working my way forward, I've sort of been like, no, it's not really that important. You know, it does, as long as it's trying to, as long as it conveys its point, or it doesn't even need to convey a point. It just needs to sort of like make you think about something. I know that I just talked about this. It could have been on this very show, you know, where I saw Mulholland Drive, and, you know, they had like an interview with Lynch beforehand, and he's like, you don't, and not everyone is going to have the same experience watching this movie.
Right.
And, you know, and one of the things he says, he's like, in life, there are things which are way more abstract than there are in this movie. And yet our minds put them together because, you know, we fill in the blanks. And, you know, filling in the blanks is kind of like the journey in a sense. And the thing with the Bus to Nowhere is, like, it doesn't make any sense in a like realistic context, but it's not supposed to. It doesn't need to. Like the point right. that it's trying to get across is perfect in this very abstract way. It's almost like an episode of The Twilight Zone, you know?
Yes, yes, that's a very good reference. It absolutely is like an episode of The Twilight Zone. You're absolutely right. Yeah, you find yourself on a bus. You don't know anybody on the bus. And right. then a man comes in and talks to you.
Yeah. And you know, the point that's this story is trying to make, and I mean, I think, I don't know, like obviously, like, that story is dealing with sort of like personal tragedy, like getting over personal tragedy in a sense, you know? And but I don't think that it's like limited to that in mm-hmm. by any means, because like, I mean, as I was reading the story, I was like kind of like reflecting on my own life and saying like, oh, am I stuck on a bus? Because I feel like most of my life I've been stuck on a bus, you know? And there are like certain moments where I'm like, I'm going to do this. Like, you know, like when I was in my mm-hmm. early 20s, I'm like, I'm going to shave my head and buy a cat, because I feel like, like those two things could go terribly wrong. Like I could have like a tremendously misshapen head, and I could hate this cat and be stuck with it for the next 15 years. But I'm guessing it'll be okay. And if I don't, then I'm just always going to be wondering what it would be like to have a cat and no hair. And mm-hmm. so I shaved my head and bought a cat, and I still shave my head to this day, and my cat's sitting right over there causing a lot of trouble, but you know, he's pretty cool most of the time. So, you know, sometimes you just got to get off the bus, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know. I really liked both of these stories. And I think that it's cool because, yeah, we've seen their episode of Rain. I guess they've done a couple episodes now and everything like that. But, you know, as like staff writers on a TV show, which has been going on for like 6 years, and then, you know, they come in and do like, you know, a seemingly random episode in the middle of the season. It's like, what exactly can you tell about their voice from watching that episode? As much as I enjoyed watching that episode, but seeing, you know, even, you know, two stories not even, you know, written together, you know, I think that it's really cool to kind of see where it is that they're coming from creatively and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I liked them a lot.
Totally agree.
So the book is called Empower, Mind Over Matter. You can get it. You can get like hard copies on Amazon and stuff, but you can also get it for the Kindle, and it's only $5. So why not? I mean, come on, right?
Do it. It's well worth it. And you know what? And I'm a longtime fan of sci-fi short story collections. So if you like those, all the more reason to get this.
There you go. There you go. Well, it's been fun talking about all of the disco news. And, oh, by the way, just one more thing, because no one's been saying this, and he needs credit where it's due, but did you see Aaron Harberts' shirt?
Oh, I want to say yes, but I can't remember what it was.
It was just a black shirt, and then in white letters across the chest, it said disco. And then on each of the sleeves, he had little Delta shields. And it's the coolest shirt ever.
That's pretty fantastic.
I want one of those. Come on, CBS. Get on that. You know, you're selling a whole bunch of Discovery crap. I don't care about any of that. Well, I will get the little, the Delta shield, of course, right? You know,
well, naturally.
But all those T-shirts and everything, you know, just give me this shirt that says disco with the two little... Anyway, okay, it's been fun talking about all of the Discovery news and the short stories by Bo-Young Kim and Erica LaPolt and Aaron Harberts' awesome disco shirt. But that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week, so here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
After the captain's documentary, I think we all wish that there had been a piano in Sisko's quarters. And at some point in every episode, someone walked in and he was just over in the corner rambling away.
Warp 5.
And there's a wipe from right to left in the screen. And you never see that on Star Trek. It completely pulls me out of the episode every time I see it.
Thanks a lot. I've never noticed it.
Yeah, I didn't notice it.
Ever.
Now I'm going to see it. Okay.
You just ruined the entire episode for everyone listening.
I'm so sorry.
The 602 Club.
that's a really smart idea, because that's also something that, you know, Caesar sees, is that we're not that different.
The Ready Room.
As with so many places, CBS, in marketing the show and getting it out to as many eyeballs as possible, they're obviously wanting fans and armchair fans and maybe would-be fans, genre fans who might give Star Trek a t- but they're still trying to get out to the great unwashed and the mundanes, and this is actually stretching the season out beyond 15 actual weeks.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's episode, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place is to join the larger conversation at the Babel Conference, which is our listener group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and we should come right up. If you want to send us an email, you can fill out the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Look for Kessel Junkie. That's my name out there. You can also find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig, which is just a silly weekly show where we have a lot of laughs. You can find me co-hosting over on the Nerd Party Network, Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast with Matthew Rushing. And speaking of podcasting and Star Wars, you can find me co-hosting a show also on the Nerd Party Network called Great Shot Kid, where we look at the work and inspirations and some alternative histories of the Star Wars galaxy. And my lovely host there is named Mike.
Yeah, it's kind of like Stage 9, but in the Kelvin timeline, you know?
Yeah.
Lots more explosions.
A lot more explosions.
Like, you know, running and jumping and, you know, magic and all those things, lightsabers, all that good stuff. So, yeah, you can find me over there doing that along with John. You can also find me on TalkFilmSociety.com doing a show called Soderbergh 2828, where we look at all 28 Steven Soderbergh movies from Sex, Lies, and Videotape all the way out up through Logan Lucky, which is coming out in a few weeks. Did you watch Contagion yet?
I haven't watched Contagion yet, but it is, setting aside, come on, kids get cranky. I gotta say, because the thing is, I know you have spoken so highly of it, I do not want it to be a distracted thing where I'm like on my iPad cooking dinner or changing a diaper or anything. I want to sit down and I want to watch it.
I think you should show it to your kids as a lesson. You know, teach them how important it is to wash their hands.
I don't want to turn them into Howard Hughes, Mike.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. You can also find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com doing a show called Commentary Track Stars, and you can find me right here on Trek.fm doing a brand new show called The Edge, which I kept on thinking about when I was reading The Edge of the Universe, in
That's
which
right.
we talk about Star Trek Discovery and all of the whatnots associated with it. It's pretty cool. So go check it out.
Yeah, you should. It's pretty awesome. I like
it. Thanks. Yeah. And on Twitter, you can find me at Mumbles3K. We'd like to thank our associate producers today, Jeff Sutter, Chris Steftenagle, and Norman C. Lau.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much. If you'd like to be like Jeff, Chris, and Norm, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm and become a donor. We've got a lot of stuff going on over there, perks, including early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. So head on over to patreon.com/trekfm, and we hope you'll join the team. All right. Well, lots of stuff going on. You know, it's been a while. Glad we can be back. And
yeah.
Next week we will be back to discuss something else. I don't even know what. Do you know what? I don't know what.
The Klingons know what.
Thank you.